Parents be warned, this message might contain content which is unsuitable for younger listeners. Your discretion is advised.
Today we're going to be talking about Shem, Ham, and Japheth and the spread of their children across the world. Shem, Ham, and Japheth, of course, are the sons of Noah, and we will be reading about them in chapter 10 of Genesis. And then we'll also leap back and read a specific story about them at the end of Genesis chapter 9, starting at verse 18. So then, we start with Genesis chapter 10, and I won't read it specifically. It's a long list of names, which you can read yourself. But Genesis chapter 10 gives us the names of the sons of Noah and the sons born to them after the flood. And this is a who's who of the nations of the world at the time of the Old Testament, and it is often called the Table of Nations for that reason. Now, first we read about the sons of Japheth, Gomer, Magog. Magog, interestingly, is mentioned again in the Bible in the book of Revelation when Gog and Magog are gathered together in war against the Lamb. You can read about that, and I believe it's chapter 20, maybe 19. Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus, the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Rephaim, so on and so forth. I'm not going to read all of them, but I do want to note verse 5. From these the coastland peoples spread in their lands, each with its own language, by their clans, in their nations. And I wanted to read that specifically because I want to talk about the word nation before we get moving on some other topics. Nations will become very important as we read the Bible. And so it's important for us to know what a nation is. Now, in America today, we have become accustomed to a certain definition of nation, which does not match the biblical definition of nation. The word is most famously used, perhaps, in the United States Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, in which it says, "One nation under God," defining the United States as one nation. But this is not the biblical understanding of one nation. The word nation, our English word nation, comes from the Latin word natus, all right? Natus is things pertaining to birth. You may recognize it from words like neonatal unit, natal, in your hospital, or prenatal care that your wife receives before she has a baby. So natus means birth. And a nation is a group of people who are of a common birth. The Latin word nation translates in the Latin Vulgate the Greek word which we read in the Septuagint, which is ethnos. Ethnos we recognize as the same word from which our English word ethnic is derived. So a nation is not properly a state or a geographical designation. It's not a governmental body. A nation, properly understood, is an ethnic group, not necessarily what we would call race. Race would be more of a broad term, but an ethnic group of a common birth. Now, the ethnos that we see in the Septuagint was, of course, a translation of the original Hebrew, which was goy, all right? Goy is the word that we see, or plural, of course, we have the em on the end, goyim, is the Hebrew, which is used to describe other nations than Israel. Again, the Israelites are a nation because they are of a common birth. And then the other nations, the Gentile nations, which we see described as the Goyim, are of another birth. So just so that you understand, when we're reading about these groups of people and their races and their nations, we're not necessarily talking about a specific place on the map or a specific governing body or what we might commonly think of as like the United Nations or something like that today. We're talking about groups of people united by a common birth heritage, certain ethnic groups, and their boundaries will change, their forms of government will change, their their locations will change, their customs will change. But in the first place, these sons, or at least many of the sons of Japheth, have spread to the coastlands, those being the sons of Javan, and the other ones seem to have the broadest spread of any of the other peoples. Magog, particularly when he's mentioned in Revelation, it is said that God called people from the four corner, or I'm sorry, Satan called people from the four corners of the earth. So we get the idea that Japheth's children had the broadest range, and we might speculate about what races these children became. Perhaps Asian people came from this. Perhaps European people came from this. We're not entirely sure. The next group that we read about are the sons of Ham, and it is a little bit more clear where these people went to. The sons of Ham were Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. Now, these remained close neighbors of the Israelites throughout the scriptures. So Cush, we understand as being in Africa, more the Ethiopian side, south in Africa, that sort of thing. Put, we understand as being more to the west in Africa. Egypt, of course, we know where Egypt is, and Canaan is the on the side of the Mediterranean there, the Palestinian area, Palestine as we would call it today, is kind of where they ended up. Now, Egypt, we get this word Egypt, our English word Egypt, from the Greek word which is essentially Egypt, and that word translates the Hebrew word Misraim, okay? And so the Misraim are the people of Egypt. Interestingly, the Egyptians still call themselves the Misr today. M-I-S-R, Misr, is the name for Egypt if you actually go to Egypt. They don't use the Greek Hellenistic form of their name. They still use the same name that the Bible gave them thousands and thousands of years ago. And so, of course, we can go on to read about the sons of Cush. Some of these spread to Sheba. We read about the queen of Sheba. Later on in the Bible, we'll also read about Dedan, which we understand to be something Arabic, or where we would find, for instance, Saudi Arabia today, perhaps. And we also read about Nimrod. We'll cover him another time. Moving on, we read, starting at verse 15, about Canaan, who is the father of, obviously, these many peoples who were in the promised land when the Israelites ultimately came and expelled them. Reading down, we finally make it to Shem. Shem is the father of all of the children of Eber, from which we get our word Hebrew. And so he's the father of the peoples that are obviously most discussed in the Bible, the sons of Abraham, the Israelites, etc. and so forth. And so he is something of a main focus, Shem. Now, Shem's people do not appear to have spread very far, but it's not entirely clear where they spread to, except that they were in the Near East. And obviously, it is from Shem that we derive our word Semitic, and we speak of anti-Semitism, someone who is opposed to the Jewish race of people. And some in Anglican circles have claimed, with some evidence, that the Shemites were white-skinned, and that Europeans, with less evidence, they claim that Europeans are the descendants of Shem, and thus claim the blessings of Shem, which I have no serious comment. But these are the clans of the sons of Noah according to their genealogies as they spread after the flood. Of course, while we're on the topic of race, it's important to mention evolution. Evolution, of course, being the secular theory that, the godless theory that humans simply sprang from nothing and have been slowly changing over time. Now, one argument in favor of evolution is the idea that humans show marks of evolution by having evolved into a multitude of different races. This could not have happened, some suppose, if all people came from one man, Noah, and such a short span of time was left for genetic diversity to enter in. However, it is not unreasonable to guess that there was genetic diversity already in the group. We have to bear in mind, Noah is not the only person here. We have Shem, Ham, and Japheth all having children, and each of them brought their own wives onto the boat. So if Noah married someone who looked significantly different from him, and he had three sons who all looked significantly different from each other, some taking after the mother and some after the father, and then each of them had a wife who looked significantly different from themselves, then there could be a broad range of races that could come from these three men in their descendants. And so by that, it would not be at all unreasonable for us to expect to see the diversity of colors and shapes that we see today among human beings. We don't need for there to be any microevolution at all. Now, I'm not saying that there is no microevolution, that, you know, I mean, obviously we don't look exactly like our parents. People do come out looking a little bit different, and there are slight changes over time. But that's not necessary for us to get the genetic diversity that we need to see the races that we have in the world today. We might guess that Adam and Eve were created with a great deal of diversity locked up between the two of them, that they both had a very rich genetic code, that they were, while they were both the same and that they were essentially human, that they had very different and distinct features, and that this was expressed in many, many races before the flood. Now, after the flood, we would expect to see a loss of genetic diversity, like we see, for instance, with the end of the Nephilim, so that we are left with the races that we have today, which made it onto the boat. There's no telling what kinds of great colors and looks that people had in the time before the flood. And this, of course, is one of the big problems with the theory of evolution. The theory of evolution is largely based on Darwin's ideas about the survival of the fittest. The survival of the fittest, however, does not indicate to us that there will ever be a new species. It simply indicates to us that weaker species will die off. So we expect with these scientific theories to see a loss of genetic diversity rather than an explosion of genetic diversity. There's no compelling evidence that's out there, and there's no strong reason for us to believe that there's ever been any introduction of new genetic diversity into the system. And that, of course, is what we see in the Bible. We see that there is a loss of diversity, and that can work very well with what we have in Scripture without any new genetic diversity being introduced. Now, let's take a closer look at Shem, Ham, and Japheth in Genesis chapter 9, verses 18 through 29, and discuss who they are and what their relevance is in the story. Remember, we're looking at the book of Genesis, and we're looking at it specifically as an introduction to the Torah, to the books of the law. And we've seen some convincing evidences that it is providing to us that we need a book of law, and that the Torah is going to be a good thing for us. It's also setting up for us our fallen condition from God's good graces, and giving us some hints about what's going to happen with that. But in addition, it's also going to set up the context of the ultimate conquest of Canaan. The people of Israel, we will find, will eventually become slaves in Egypt. They will have their mass exodus from Egypt, and ultimately will conquer the promised land and wipe out the Canaanites. So we have a story from Genesis chapter 9, which gives us some foreshadowing for that. If we were to look in verse 20 of chapter 9, Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Now Noah, here we see him drunk in the tent, not behaving as perfectly as we might hope for a man who was called perfect. And his son Ham comes in and sees his nakedness. Now, what exactly are we talking about when we say that he sees his nakedness? Is it simply that he saw him naked and then turned around and walked out? It seems somewhat unlikely to me, because of the passage itself, that when Noah wakes up and knows that Ham has seen him, he lays a curse on him and his descendants. It seems a little bit strange that someone would do that simply for having been seen naked. Some have speculated that seeing the nakedness of Noah was in fact something much worse, that seeing the nakedness is a euphemism for perhaps an inappropriate sexual act. And that is speculation, not entirely without reason, but also questionable and dubious. I wouldn't teach it as a certain doctrine, certainly, but some have speculated that this was the first homosexual act which Ham has committed against Noah while he's drunk and unconscious in his tent. His brothers have a very different reaction. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness. Now, that might just debunk the theory which was just espoused in saying that their faces were turned. They did not even see their father's nakedness. So there is a strong likelihood that in this passage we're talking about literal seeing. And I think that that's interesting because, as I mentioned, it seems that being seen naked is not such a shameful thing in our society anymore. Perhaps, rather than trying to conform the passage to our understanding of nakedness, we should conform our understanding of nakedness to the passage, and we should avoid being seen naked by people. That is a bit of a shocker, I'm sure, for college students who are prone these days to go streaking, that is running around naked. But nakedness is indeed a shameful thing. We ought to cover up our shame. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be Jehovah, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. And that gets us through chapter 9. So there is a curse pronounced, and there is a blessing pronounced. And God pronounces this curse, interestingly, specifically upon Canaan. And that's kind of interesting because Ham is the one who saw the nakedness, and yet Canaan is the one who is accursed, Canaan being the son of Ham. And that leads us to some strange questions, like why not curse Ham if Ham is the one who saw it? And why curse Canaan and not, for instance, Egypt or one of these other sons of Ham? We have no strong answer for that except for context. It's quite possible that Noah pronounced a curse on Ham and all of his descendants, but that we only have recorded the curse on Canaan because it's Canaan who is in our immediate view. We are looking for the Israelites to ultimately conquer the Promised Land, and at the time that this was written, they had not yet done so. So this would have been an encouragement to them in its original context that they are indeed chosen to go and conquer the Canaanites, that Noah himself said that the Canaanites were to be their servants. So, what exactly is up with this curse? Are we to believe from reading this that Noah can simply wish evil on people and thus it happens? Is that how curses work? Can Noah just say something bad should happen to someone and because he said it, it will happen? And if Noah can do it, can anyone do it? Do we have this power to just lay curses on people and simply by saying, "I hope an evil thing happens to you," that it happens? I would think that that's not the case. Even if it was, I would suppose it might not be something that we ought to do. What I would suggest is that Noah here is prophetically declaring the future. That Noah is not so much predicting what will happen or simply saying what he would like to happen. I think that he is prophetically declaring that the Canaanites will ultimately become servants to the sons of Shem and the sons of Japheth. And spoiler alert, that is ultimately what happens. Eventually the Israelites do conquer Canaan, and they do subject the Canaanites to much genocide and slavery. So then, that will bring us through Genesis chapters 9 and 10.